God, take it all. You know better than I do what I should do and where I should go. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. Step three is referred to as a beginning and a decision. Though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. I'm feeling like I can do this. I'm feeling like God is going to hold my hand through the whole thing. I know He's there. I've read We Agnostics. I've studied Appendix 2 at the back of the book on page 567, which is your homework assignment for tonight, is to read Appendix 2, page 567. And I want you to feel Him with you, and if you don't, ask Him into your life. God is a gentleman. He doesn't go where He's not invited. Invite Him into your life. I urge you to do that. It really makes such a difference. Next. Now, before we read past the word next, one of the misconceptions about step four is that it's difficult, and we're going to find out that it's not difficult. One of the misconceptions about step four, and you'll hear this in the fellowship, but you will not read this in the book, is that we wait. And we do a step every year or a step every 20 years or something. It says next. It doesn't say wait. Stop waiting to be working the perfect food plan, to be working the perfect program, to do the perfect fourth step. You'll be waiting the rest of your life. We are not going to hang your fourth step on the refrigerator. Nobody is going to grade your paper. Nobody is going to see it. Don't worry about getting an A on it. Just do the best you can. Just answer the questions. There's not anybody in here that doesn't know who they're mad at and doesn't know what they fear and doesn't know the sexual harms done other people in their life. There's not one question on the fourth step that you do not know the answer to. And that we're going to do is we're going to smash some of these myths. But the first one is stop waiting to be doing the thing perfectly to fare forth. Go forth. Do it. Next, we launched on a course of vigorous action, not vigorous thinking. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once. There's that word again. There's the timing. First, it's described as next. Then it's described as at once. Followed by a strenuous effort, there's that word effort, it's a working word, it's a verb, to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. That was step four. Now, when he talks about causes and conditions, what is he talking about? He is talking about where anger comes from, where fear comes from, where these various things come from. Now, God gives us basic instincts of life. And when my future ambitions in these areas are threatened, I will become fearful. I will become resentful if you are interrupting my ambitions for the future. If you are threatening to take away what I currently have in these areas, you're going to scare me. You're going to threaten me. You're going to make it so that I'm uncomfortable. I'm going to strike out at you, and in retaliation, you're going to strike out at me causing me pain and suffering, and in so doing, you're going to cause me to resent you. Fear is, I may not get my way in the future. Resentment is, I didn't get my way in the past. Fear and resentment come from a threat to what I currently hold on to in the basic instincts, or my ambitions for the future in these areas. Selfishness gets triggered when you don't stick to my script. Self-seeking is triggered when you don't give me the results I want, and dishonesty is triggered when I try to lie to power drive my will into a situation so that I can either avoid pain or I can attain something I want. What are the basic instincts of life? They are all God-given. They are put in and hardwired into us by God, and God never gave us anything bad. The very first instinct is the social instinct. The social instinct is hardwired into us by God, and the social instinct is something that God wired into us because even cavemen realized that by working together in groups, they could accomplish more with less effort than they all could accomplish individually. And that's why in all social cultures, there is a feeling or code of helping one another for the greater good. They don't necessarily come and fix your barn when it burns down because of some altruism, but they make sure that they're there for you so that you, in turn, if something happens, will be there for them. And they found that in farming, in hunting, in providing for their families, by dividing labor and working together, they could get more done. In ancient Judaism, there is what's called a minyan. Must be 10 men coming together to pray. Is it important that it be men or women? Not anymore, but let's just take a look at that. If this was, say, 1400, and there's no phones, and there's no email, yes, there was no email at that time, or text messaging, or any of that, and this was like 1400, by requiring 10 men to come to the prayer session, if one of those men didn't show, they knew something was wrong at Joe's house. So they would leave and go over to Joe's house to make sure everything was okay. And that is hardwired into us by God. When they were hunting, moose maybe, that said, damn, these moose are pooping all over the house over here. Let's kill a few of them. No, but what they did was they found that if one's the lookout and one does this and one does that, they can split the meat and get more accomplished with less effort. And we can all understand that. So I either want to be the leader of the group or I want to be part of the group. And if you look at kids in the high school cafeteria, you see manifestations of that social instinct all over the place. You are not judged necessarily just by who you are. You're judged by who you sit and eat lunch with, right? You are part of a group. Let me be part of the group, or let me be the leader of the group, or let me be the clown, let me be the treasurer, let me be the whatever, but I have my role in the group. And who are some of you look back on your high school days at Friend High School or wherever you went to high school or Mather, you will see that there are manifestations of this. And what is the one thing that people can do in those situations that will really scare you and make you mad? They'll try to exclude you from the group. And not only will they affect your social, but one of the other aspects of the social is self-esteem. Self-esteem is more often not what I think of me, but it's what I think you think of me. What I think of myself is usually more governed not by what I see in the mirror, but what I think you think of me. If you think I'm a pretty good egg, then I'll pretty much like me and I'll be okay with me. But if you guys start thinking I'm not such a nice guy, well, that's going to affect the way I think of myself. And if you threaten that, I'm going to get hurt. I'm going to hurt you in response to that. You're going to retaliate in kind, creating pain and suffering for me. And as you do so, you're going to create fear and anger, and you're going to upset me to the point where I am going to feel these things and my mental twist is going to get triggered. Another thing that's very important about the social instinct is when it comes to ambitions, maybe I've been sitting over here at the lunch table with just, say, you guys. And I'm kind of getting tired of sitting here eating lunch with you guys, and I want to go sit over there with them to eat lunch. And I kind of work at it, and and I talk to Paula, hey, Paula, hey, how's everything going, blah, blah, blah. And my ambition for the future is to be in with that group because I perceive that that group has more prestige than this group for whatever reason, and they reject me. The same thing is going to happen, or they accept me, and the same kind of thing is going to happen, but I find out that so-and-so or such doesn't want me to be part of the group. So you can all see how this kind of works together. The social instinct is a very important instinct, and we can see that there's going to be a disturbance when our ambitions for the future in that instinct, or currently what we're holding on to, having lunch over here with you guys, is hurt or threatened. Okay, let's examine the next important instinct. Not that any of them are unimportant. It's the security instinct. Very, very important instinct is the security instinct. And it's got a couple of parts to it. The very first thing that's going to create a situation for me that is going to affect me is my personal or my physical security. In other words, if a bear came out of the woods, and he's trying to kill me, that's going to create pain and suffering for me because it's going to affect my personal safety, my personal security. If somebody came in here with a gun and threatened to shoot me, that's going to do the same kind of thing. But let's look for a few subtler kind of situations when it comes to the security instinct. Emotional security is definitely a part of the security instinct. Emotional security. Emotional is very, very important. If you keep acting in a way that is a threat to what I currently have in terms of emotional security, or if, let's just say, for example, my friend Joe is going to marry Linda, and Linda is just a hard, hard person to get along with, she's going to affect my emotional security. And when she comes into my life, I'm afraid because I know the kind of person she is, and she's going to upset my emotional security or my ambitions for passivity, for tranquility in that area in the future. So emotional security is very important. If every day my boss is coming in and threatening to fire me, not only is that going to be a threat to my emotional security, but it'll segue us nicely into financial security. Remember I said before, I don't think it was yesterday, I think it was this morning, when you listen to Fifth Steps and you take inventories and you do inventories, you will find that most of the stuff on there will revolve around finances and romances, finances and romances. So financial security is something that is hardwired by God into our psyches so that we will provide for our families the food, the shelter, the clothing, and the things that we need so that we can survive. And if you look all through ancient teachings, it's always provide, but don't spend everything, save a little bit, there could be a famine coming or whatever. Now, I've lived this way of life for 33 years, and like everybody, I appreciate living one day at a time, but I bet and I hope I'm not the only person in the room that has a savings account, that has some money set aside for a rainy day. Luckily, I live in the desert, but I try to, provide for a rainy day. Every month, I pay a sizable bill so that I can buy life insurance for my 17-year-old. I have a daughter. And before you go home tomorrow, you're going to hear a very famous story about my little girl when she was a little girl. It's the famous Hannah story. But I provide my Hannah with a life insurance policy. Every month I pay money to State Farm Insurance so that if I die, they will give her a sizable check so that she can begin her life with something that is a remnant of my life. And why would I do that if I didn't have that security instinct hardwired into me? I would just take that money every month and put it towards something I wanted to do, something fun that would be for me. But I have a very strong sense that doing that is just wrong, and that my job is to provide for my little girl, who is now not so little. She's 17, but when she was little, it doesn't matter, but she's my kid. So my job is to provide for her future. And if I were to stop that policy and use that money on myself, and I would do that, I just wouldn't feel right about that. I would rather do without certain things than not provide for her, because I have a sense that it's wrong. And any time I'm trying to make any decision and the shitty committee is in my head trying to talk myself into it, the answer is no. When it comes from God, it just feels right. I don't have to sit and debate. God's will is consistent. My will is insistent. Got to have it now. We're going to talk about that a lot when we get to step 11. What is the difference between me telling me something and God telling me something? And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. God doesn't have to shout. God doesn't have to, right now. That's me. That's my ego. Okay. So we see where anger comes from. We see where fear comes from. These are threats. And the last instinct is the sex instinct. The sex instinct is something that is hardwired into us by God. I'm told it's a very enjoyable thing. I'm not sure, but I'm told that by others. But if we didn't have the sex instinct, we wouldn't recreate ourselves. We wouldn't go through the work and the expense of courtship and wooing the other person and, you know, trying to make them feel like we can be somebody that they could have this relationship with, whether it's forever or it's not forever, whatever it is. But the sex instinct is something that is very hardwired into us by God, and it's there for reasons, and we're going to talk about the sex instinct a little bit more when we get to the end of the chapter. But if you're threatening to take away what I already have in that area, like if I'm currently married and I see you putting the moves on my wife, you're going to scare me. I'm going to resent you. I'm going to strike out at you. You're going to create pain and suffering for me. I don't know why, but some of the girls are laughing at me in this room, and I'm not trying to look at them. But okay. But anyway, but you're going to create pain and suffering for me, and I'm going to retaliate in kind, creating pain and suffering for you. Or if I want to go out with, just say, Paula, for example, and I'm trying to go out with Paula as a sexual partner, but I see Paula going over and talking to Tim, I'm going to fear and resent Tim because he's horning in on Paula and I have designs on her myself. So we can all see how that works to create fear, to create resentment. And as that fear and as that resentment permeates my soul, it will trigger the mental twist. When the mental twist is out of whack, I'm not sure why I'm getting laughed at, but I am. Okay, when the mental twist is antagonized like that, the mental twist is going to scream out irresistibly for what it knows will make it feel better instantly, which is the food, because the mental twist is looking for the effect. And as the effect takes over for about 9 seconds and we feel better for about 9 seconds, once we eat the food and it's inside of us, we now trigger the physical allergy. we will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat this way again, and we will repeat that cycle over and over and over again, the mind telling me the food's okay and the body ensuring that it's not. And so we can see the method of killing us that the food manifests. And for a long time in your life, you treated the symptom of an illness as the illness itself. You looked at the food and said, bad food. You looked at the weight and said, ugh. And you tried to treat the weight and the food. The weight and the food are not the problem. The weight and the food are manifestations of the problem, and the causes and conditions are the fears and angers that trigger the mental twist. The mental twist drives you into the food. The food creates 7 seconds of euphoria, but unfortunately triggers the mental, or excuse me, the physical allergy, creating the craving. You trigger the craving, you find it impossible to control the amount you eat the food, you keep eating the food, you eat more of the food, you eat so much that you can't move, you go to the refrigerator looking for another turkey to eat so that you'll feel better from eating the pizza, you eat the turkey, then the Oreos, then the pudding, then the Jell-O, then the Snickers bars, and you wonder why you're so fat, so you treat the weight and the food, and they are not the problem. If I go to Anchorage and you understand that, then my trip here was a success. If food was the problem, jails, hospitals, treatment centers would cure me. They don't. I've never been in jail, but you know, I'm a nice Jewish boy. I don't go to jail. Okay. I might get moose poop thrown at me, but I'm not. I don't go to jail. No. If weight was the problem, then losing weight, as I've done many times, would have cured me, and it didn't. If being thinner cured me, I wouldn't be here today. Food and weight are not the problem. The problem is the anger, the fear, as it manifests through the defects of character, excuse me, the fear and the anger, the fear, the anger, dishonesty, selfishness, self-seeking are the defects of character which will trigger the strange mental twist. The twist drives us into the food. It wears you down. You try to resist it with willpower, but you can't, because eventually what's going to happen is the strange mental twist will wear you down, break you down, piss you off. You're going to get mad at somebody. You're going to get scared of something. And it's at that moment, your brain sees nothing wrong with eating the food. You eat it. You trigger the allergy, pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again, and you will repeat that over and over and over again. Is there anybody in this room, and I didn't want to stop, but I'm going to just for a minute, I don't want to get too sidetracked. Is there anybody in this room still thinking that food and weight are the problem? Good. They are not. They are manifestations of the problem. They are the symptoms of a problem. Some of you are in the healthcare field. Is a runny nose the problem with a cold? Nope, it's a virus. The virus is the problem. The runny nose is a symptom of the problem. Is that clear? Okay. Help. Oh, therefore we started on a, I think I'm therefore, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Come on, okay. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. That was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. Now, here's another reason why you have to have step two. I don't know any other way to exemplify this but through my daughter. Hannah is 17 years old. She doesn't live with me anymore, but if I would have said to Hannah today, Hannah, go clean your room, she would have used language that would have made you and the moose embarrassed. She can use language. I don't talk like that. She didn't get that from me. There's no way, you're not putting that one on me. No, I don't talk like that, do I? Okay. She's got a vocabulary. I don't know where she got it from, but it wasn't me or her mother. We don't talk like that. But same scenario. Hannah, go clean your room. Only this time, I got a MasterCard here that God gave me this morning. There's no limit on it, and we don't have to pay the bill. Go in your room. Anything you want in that room, updated, replaced, is free. Whatever you don't want, you clear out of that room, and we'll buy you another one for free. You don't have to worry about paying for it. There wouldn't be anything in that room but walls. That's the deal God is making you. Stop hanging on to the broken iPad. Stop hanging on to the clothes that you haven't worn since 1971. Stop hanging on to the resentment from 1966. Stop hanging on to the broken love affair from 1979. Let it go. It's not working for you. Stop fighting the battles that don't exist. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. My God. The wedding that you didn't go to from 1973. Let it go. God wants to replace all of it with new things and beautiful things. He loves you. He's not going to give you anything that isn't wonderful. Good Lord, put everything out on the curb. He's not going to take anything from you that he wants you to have. My Lord, what kind of God do you have in your head that would have you stubbing your toe on the same resentment for decades? What kind of God did I have in my head that would permeate my soul with the same fears and the same crap from years and years and years ago? Good Lord, let it go. Leave retribution to heaven. Oh, God, the things I carried with me. Oh, God, and you know, I'd pick it all up again if I stopped working the steps. Mm-hmm. What that teacher said to me in 1962, what that kid said to me in 1968, what that Safeway charged us for the grapes yesterday. Let it go. All of it. Turn your life inside out. Strip down metaphorically and let him have it. He knows you. He's not taking anything away from you he wants you to have. Aren't you done playing with that resentment now? Aren't you done playing with that fear now? Aren't you done playing with that person now that you haven't seen them for 20 years? Aren't you done obsessing about that? Have you eaten enough food over it? Should we call the pizzeria one more time? Come on. Let it go. Let it go. Is this making it a little simpler? Is this breaking it down? Are we demystifying some of this? This is so simple. Okay. Uh-oh. Help. Oh. Oh, boy. Oh, thanks. Okay, good. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Not our successes, our failure. That's why you hear people, well, you need to list your character assets along with the... No, you don't. It doesn't say anything about that. We're looking for the reasons that we were dying in the food, not the reasons we were good teachers. Come on. All right, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Here's your specific example of what, not example, your specific instructions as to what to do. Set them on paper. It's a four-column resentment section. There's the resentment, fears, and sexual harms done others. We're going to pull apart the resentment, and then we're going potty, and we'll come back. But the first one, the first column in the resentment section of the four columns is, who or what do you resent? And it's not always going to be a person. In most cases, it's going to be a person that harmed you. But there are resentments that people have that have nothing to do with a person. For example, I always had a resentment against the saying, blood is thicker than water. I hate when people said that because it always left me out. Anybody that said blood is thicker than water was automatically excluding me because I didn't have any blood relatives. I didn't have cousins. I didn't have aunts and uncles. I didn't have grandparents. I didn't have nieces and nephews. And so when people would say blood is thicker than water, it automatically left me out. And that's not against a person. That's an example of some of the things that you can resent that have nothing to do with a person. But the first column of your inventory in the four-column resentment section is, who or what do you resent? People, institutions, or principles, what I just named as a principle, with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. Column two, what did they do to you that made you mad? Is this hard? I mean, if this is hard, if you don't understand how to do this, please tell me and I'll try to explain it another way, maybe in Yiddish. Okay. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relations, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. Third column of the inventory is, what part of self is affected? First column, who or what? Second column, what did they do to you? Third column, what part of self is affected? First column, who or what? Second column, what did they do to you? In 19 words or less, though. Don't write a damn book about what they did to you. Third column, what part of self is affected? But no novels on what they did to you.